You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Chema Gaudet. Once again, most of Idaho is back in crisis standards of care. It has only been 4 months since the Delta variant surge made it necessary for healthcare facilities to need this designation. And those standards were reactivated earlier this week. However, state health leaders say this time it's different. In fact, during a news briefing yesterday, the head of the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, Dave Jeppesen, said our state's entire health system is, quote, in a very fragile condition, unquote, due to hospitals facing staffing shortages and a dire blood supply problem. So joining us today are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, as well as a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, and Dr. Rob Cavanaugh, president of St. Luke's Clinic. I want to thank both of you for joining us today.
Thanks
for having me.
Thanks, Gemma.
So as I mentioned, on Monday, Idaho went back into crisis standards of care for the southern half of our state. Dr. Pate, I want to start with you. What does this mean?
So hospitals have just been amazing during this pandemic. They have been creative. They have tried to figure out how do they flex up for the additional cases. They've canceled surgeries. They've used space that we don't ordinarily use for patient care. But there comes a point when you start running out of options, and there's either not enough space, there's not enough staff, there's not enough ventilators, whatever it is, there's something that now is making it that you cannot continue to make these flexible arrangements more. And when we get to that, the previous, what I described is the, what you heard in the TIA called contingency standards. We're not doing things normal, but we're still able to make do and give people all the care they need. When we get to crisis standards of care, which means we're running out of options, it means a lot of different things, but it may mean different things at different hospitals. So for example, when we first went into crisis standards this time, it was more because St. Al's was under even more stress than St. Luke's was. So St. Luke's still had some options to play with, but St. Al's was running out of options. And we saw that in one hospital in the state, there was a terribly tragic case. If I recall the details correctly, a 33-year-old woman with a non-COVID situation that could have been treated, but there was no place to send her. There was nobody that could take her, and she died. And so that's one extreme. Certainly not all of our hospitals are at that point. The other thing can be that, we simply get to a situation where there's not an ICU bed available. And so somebody might have to be kept in the emergency room or in a hallway. And obviously that's not the standard of care we would ordinarily provide, but that's what we have to do to make do. We had a situation during the first crisis standards of care sometime back where we actually ran out of a certain type of equipment to help patients breathe for a while. And so nurses and respiratory therapists and all had to stand over patients with what we call ambu bags that you forcibly force oxygen into the patient until we could get a new supply of equipment. So it's all kinds of things, but it means that we can't give everybody the usual care that we would give, and that may adversely affect outcomes, and it's not good. And we have to understand it's not just crisis standards of care for COVID patients. It's crisis standards for all patients, that just like the 33-year-old woman I mentioned.
Dr. Cavanaugh, how is St. Luke's doing during this latest surge?
Well, I think it's challenging for sure. And our teams are extremely resilient. We have incredible leaders. We've been doing this for 2 years now. And so our teams just know what to do. But I'll share, you know, the physicians, the nurses, our environmental service coworkers, everyone, I mean, they're exhausted. And we've got additional staff and physicians to augment our teams so that we can take care of the increased number of patients. But we have a lot of people who have picked up extra shifts and stayed late and all those things. So we're managing. And again, the teams are very resilient and will do whatever it takes, but they're exhausted.
We found a chart from the Idaho Hospital Association that shows a dramatic difference between how many vaccinated and unvaccinated people are in Idaho hospitals with COVID. So I've got a question for each of you. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Pate. I think that this chart backs up what you have been saying since the start of the pandemic. We're going to put this graph on our website this afternoon so folks can look at it themselves. But Dr. Pate, can we talk about this graph? I know you've been able to look at what I'm talking about.
Yes, I saw this earlier in the week with a meeting with the state. And I'll tell you that the graph, if you were to do it for our country, looks similar and perhaps even a little bit more dramatic. But what this graph shows is that if you get COVID and you have severe disease and you require hospitalization, that you're roughly about five times more likely at this point to end up hospitalized than if you're fully vaccinated. And also there's differences between people that are not vaccinated that get hospitalized and people that are vaccinated. And what this graph shows that is if you're not fully vaccinated, so if you if you haven't gotten any shots or you just got one shot or you haven't had enough time since your second shot, that when you're in the hospital, you're going to have a longer length of stay. The number of days that you have to be in the hospital, it was 8.4 days on average for those who were not fully vaccinated versus 6.2 days if you were fully vaccinated versus only 4 days if you also had your booster. And then what we also see is that we see younger patients when they're not fully vaccinated. And so the average age of the patient admitted that was unvaccinated or not fully vaccinated was 60 years. And with the fully vaccinated, it was 68 years. So it means that more younger people end up in the hospital. And then the likelihood of you needing critical care, being admitted to the ICU, if you were not fully vaccinated, it was 14.7%. If you were fully vaccinated, it was 10.6%. So again, what this in a nutshell, what this graph tells us is, as you said, Gemma, what we've been saying all along, vaccines aren't perfect. They are not going to help everybody avoid infection. They're not going to help everybody avoid getting sick, but it greatly decreases your chance of getting severely ill. And if you do, you still do better in the hospital than those who are not fully vaccinated.
So Dr. Cavanaugh, let's break it down to what that looks like here then. I know right now you have 200 people across your healthcare system hospitalized with COVID. How many of them are fully vaccinated? And I ask that because I want to get into what I think so many medical professionals have talked about, what Dr. Pate just said, is what vaccines do for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's break it down. So 200 patients across our system with COVID, 64 of them are fully vaccinated. And let's define what we mean by fully vaccinated. We mean the primary series. So if that's Johnson & Johnson, it's one shot. And if it's Moderna or Pfizer, it's the two shot. Doesn't necessarily include the booster, right? And people will look at these numbers and say, well, gosh, almost a third of the patients that you have with COVID are fully vaccinated, and use that as an argument for the vaccines aren't as effective as they're being, you know, touted. The numbers don't tell the whole story. And this goes along with what Dr. Pate was saying earlier. the folks who end up getting admitted to the hospital with COVID, if they're vaccinated, tend to be older, tend to have more medical problems, tend to have a better course. They're there a shorter amount of time, less likely to be intubated, all those things. And so the vaccine isn't going to protect against universal infection, but it makes it much less likely to have a bad outcome. And that's the key take home. And I think that that gets lost sometimes when we talk about all these numbers and people want to point to something and say, you know, see, I told you it doesn't necessarily work. True, it's not the cure-all, but the bad outcomes that we see almost universally are in the unvaccinated folks. I just got done taking care of a young lady who was in the hospital with her second bout of COVID, never been vaccinated, and we're not seeing those types of things in people who have been vaccinated.
And the FDA this week just deauthorized two of the three monoclonal antibody treatments this week, saying that they don't work against Omicron, and they're closing down these treatment centers. I know for a lot of people who have gotten COVID, this has been a saving grace for them. Dr. Pate, some people are angry about this decision by the FDA. So can you explain the reason why they have deauthorized this right now?
Yeah. Well, I understand their feeling, but I think if they understood what was really happening, they wouldn't be angry. So this decision by the FDA was not surprising in the least. We expected it. In fact, we had already gotten to the point where the providers were not ordering these particular monoclonal antibodies any longer. Those monoclonal antibodies were a godsend when we were dealing with Delta. And this was for people that were at significant risk of being hospitalized, but who got infected. And what we could do is when they first got infected, we get them in for these monoclonal antibodies. And what this is in essence doing, it's like a speed vaccination. Instead of, you know, we talk about getting your vaccine and being fully vaccinated 2 weeks later, this is kind of like getting your antibodies like right away. And so it helped keep a lot of those people out of the hospital. But what people need to understand is, again, going back to your show, Gemma, to 2020, we started talking about this. If we don't do something to stop the transmission of this virus so that we don't have such worldwide high transmission levels, we are going to get variants. And you're eventually going to get variants that have an ability to get around some of these antibodies. And what happened is with Omicron got to the point that two of these monoclonal products no longer worked against it. Those are the ones the FDA deauthorized. And the reason we shouldn't be upset about that is even if we still had them, they're not going to help you, because all the cases that we're seeing in Idaho today are Omicron. So it just wouldn't do you any good. There is one monoclonal left that does work against Omicron, and that's called Sotrovimab. The problem is there's just not enough supply because we have record numbers of people getting infected, and there's just not enough of it. They can't make it fast enough. And so the little bit that we do get, we have to triage that to the people that are the absolute highest risk patients. And so a lot of people can't get it right now. We hope that situation will change, but that's what happened.
Before we get to a ton of listener questions, I do want to talk about what's going on in schools across the Treasure Valley right now. So here we are back in crisis standards of care, and at a school board meeting earlier this week, the West Ada School District decided in a 3-2 vote to stop informing parents when their children are exposed to COVID. Yet at the same time, the Caldwell School District decided to bring a mask mandate back through February 14. So Dr. Pate, Dr. Cavanaugh, I would like both of your thoughts on this. And Dr. Pate, why don't we start with you?
Okay, we'll get the bleeper button ready.
Sam, get it ready.
So get ready, Sam. Well, you know, this is one more example that the, you know, the West Ada School Board is not taking into consideration that many families have somebody that is high risk at home and maybe having plans to visit somebody that's high risk. And it's pretty darn important to know whether your child may have been in close contact with somebody who's infected. Now, you know, they talk about, you know, now the big thing is, well, you know, parents' rights. So they say they're not going to do these notifications, but what happened to parents' rights to know if their child has been infected? So I understand that there are some parents that are tired of getting the notices, don't want to get the notices. Okay, well, that's fine. Let them opt out. But let the parents who are concerned and do have these high-risk situations, let them get notifications. And I've talked to many parents that are very upset because they have these kind of situations. So again, I think it's just a lack of either understanding the implications of their actions or just lack of empathy for these folks that do have these challenges at home. On the other hand, I would like to give a shout out to Caldwell School District. I have not thought that they have made all the right decisions in the past, but I'll tell you what, I was quite impressed with the decision they made. And, you know, we've got to get to a reasonable point on this. You know, I'm not suggesting that kids need to wear masks for the rest of the school, for the rest of their lives, even for the rest of this school year. But when we are having record levels of infection, when our hospitals are saying that we're in crisis standards of care, it is the height of recklessness and irresponsibility to not take measures to try to slow down the transmission in the schools. The superintendent will tell parents, well, you can check the school dashboard to see. No, you can't. First of all, the school dashboard isn't anywhere close to reporting all of the cases. And second, is that you can look at the school dashboard, but that doesn't tell you about the particular exposures for your child. So, you know, I would like to say that I'm still getting surprised by the West Ada School Board, but I no longer am surprised by these things. But I do give kudos to Caldwell, and I'll stop there.
And Dr. Cavanaugh, you know, I think it's important to point out too, as Dr. Pate mentioned, that I think there's this idea of, well, kids are going to have to wear masks forever. You know, I know at my children's own school, we have a mask mandate right now. They're going to revisit it at the end of the month. We've upgraded my children's masks to surgical masks. I've had conversations with my own children saying that we need to get through this. So here is what you need to do. Because we are also seeing more children being impacted by this and being hospitalized by the Omicron variant. Is that a fair statement?
100%. I'm looking at our dashboard right now, Gemma. We've got 11 pediatric patients in the hospital currently with COVID, and we just weren't seeing that before. I'm in the same boat that you are. I've got two teens in the West Ada, you know, school district, and I agree wholeheartedly with Dr. Pate. I really admire Caldwell for their courage and doing what they're doing. You know, we saw some schools in Nampa have to close because so many, mm-hmm. you know, the staff were infected with COVID. And there's so many things that we could do that are simple and straightforward and could be really effective. I think adults tend to make a much bigger deal out of wearing masks than kids do. My boys are 14 and 15 and they tell me it's no big deal, Dad. None of my friends really mind. And I think adults just really blow it out of proportion. So I'm completely aligned with Dr. Pate on this one.
Let's get to some listener questions because we have quite a few. We've been getting a lot of questions about masks because the CDC did recommend that we wear higher quality masks. But now there's information coming out saying some of these masks are counterfeit and they don't work, even if they say they're KN95s. So in fact, Kristen from Sun Valley writes in, I'm totally confused. I have a box of KN95 masks. The box does have a required GB2626-2019, but there is no imprint of this on the mask itself. So she wants to know, are these safe to use? Dr. Pate, what do people need to look for when they are looking for either a KN95 or maybe a surgical mask?
Yeah, so KN95s and N95s are going to be higher quality masks. When we say quality, what we're talking about is the degree of respiratory protection. I'm not talking about the materials necessarily, but the degree of respiratory protection will be higher with a KN95 or an N95 than with a surgical mask. In the simplest terms, this is not a full explanation, but in the simplest terms, a big component of that is the KN95s and the N95s mold to your face much better. When you put on a surgical mask, those are very good, but you're often going to see that people have gaps in that mask around where it goes over their cheeks. So these KN95s and the N95s are better. Now, when you're trying to assess whether these are legit, because there's plenty of fakes out there, it's harder with the KN95s, and that's because those are not made in the United States generally. Those mostly come from China, sometimes from Korea. That is why when you look at the KN95 mask, you will not see the NIOSH, N-I-O-S-H certification, because that's only for American masks. And no KN95s or hardly any of them are going to be American. So Kristen is, that's really good. She's looking for the right marking, which is that GB2626. Now, it could be that it'll say 2019. That's when that was made, but it could be another year. But what you want to look is for other clues, almost like what you would do for an email that's trying to spam you. Is the spelling correct? If it says FDA approved, that's a fake. FDA doesn't approve masks. If it says, my general rule for restaurants is if the sign out says good food, then it probably isn't. And the same thing, if this is saying, it's a great mask or this is, really high quality mask, or it probably isn't. So you need to look at those things. Obviously, to the extent that you can buy from known reputable companies, that's good. But with the N95, you will have that NIOSH certification if it's a real N95. And you can go to their site and they will actually give you a list of people that make that those masks. I would warn people, even with these masks, you will still find some that come with valves. Don't get them. Do not get a valve in a mask. That's going to undermine their effectiveness. And then finally, I think if you're just totally lost, and it would be understandable if you are, there are some good places you can go to. For example, we have the only nonprofit that I know of that sells masks is Project N95, and they will have a good selection, including for kids.
Dr. Kavanaugh, I want to get in a question from Kathy. She writes, I have friends that believe the COVID-19 hospitalizations are overstated. They cite that many patients are being admitted to hospitals for other issues, and they just happen to have COVID, so they're being counted as COVID patients. For example, a patient has a heart attack and they test positive for COVID, so the hospitals say they're a COVID patient. Could that be true? If so, why? Or is this another piece of misinformation, Dr. Kavanaugh?
Yeah, so the question is, COVID admissions versus COVID-related admissions, right? So patients Correct. Coming in with other conditions who happen to test positive for COVID. Well, the first thing I'd say is we don't test every single patient who walks in the door for COVID. It's not like there's a huge number of patients coming in with other conditions and, oh, by the way, they have COVID. Are there a handful of those who are included in the numbers? Probably. But remember that if someone is COVID positive and they're in with a heart attack or appendicitis or something else, they do require increased resources. We have to isolate them and we have to put on all the PPE and they typically stay longer. So it does impact the care that we are, need to deliver. I would say it's such a minuscule number of patients. I don't think that it significantly changes the number. The vast majority of people who are being reported as COVID positive are there because of COVID and they have respiratory issues, shortness of breath, fever, the things that require those treatments.
Oh, we want to listen to a voicemail right now. We actually got a question from a listener for the Doctors Roundtable. From Barcelona, Spain. Yeah, they listen all the way over in Spain. Take a listen to this.
We have a question for Dr. Pate concerning if you are fully vaccinated and boosted and you happen to be exposed to somebody who has COVID-19 with the Omicron and you happen to catch it, what kind of shedding is a fully vaccinated person doing? I would assume that somebody who's not vaccinated would shed much more of the virus, but how much does a fully vaccinated person shed? Thanks so much and keep up the great work. We love listening to you. Bye.
Dr. Pate.
Wow. Well, buenos dias to my fans in Spain. That's a fantastic question because one of the things that is being touted by those who are spreading misinformation about the vaccines is that there is no point in getting vaccinated because if you get infected, you shed the same amount of virus as those that are unvaccinated that get ill. And so this question allows for the full story. So it is true that if you just check, like on that PCR test, that you just check the number of copies of virus, so-called viral load. If you check that on infected, unvaccinated and an infected vaccinated person, they'll be very similar. And so that's where that misinformation came from. The problem is that's not the whole story. The story is you actually don't care about what that viral load is because it's actually a very poor predictor of how much virus is in your nose that's infectious. That's what you care about. And a recent study just showed that, in fact, even though they might have similar viral loads, the person that is fully vaccinated has a far lower infectious viral load. In fact, it was about 5 times less amount of infectious virus. The other reason that it is, if you're going to get infected, it's for others, it's better if you are vaccinated, is that if you look at the 5th day after the onset of symptoms, you can detect infectious virus in the unvaccinated person in 84.6% of the time. But in the fully vaccinated person, you can only detect it in about half. So it's lower. So people that are fully vaccinated to get infected, they will have less amount of infectious virus and they will have it for a shorter period of time.
Dr. Kavanaugh, Tiffany writes in and she says, because we are back in crisis standards of care, does that mean surgeries are going to be postponed again?
We're in the process of, evaluating day by day what adjustments we need to make in order to adequately care for the community. And so there's tons of things that we're doing behind the scenes that the community probably won't even realize in order to increase our capacity in the hospital. One of the things that we're doing is looking at the surgical cases day by day and predicting how many admissions we will have based on that, and deciding whether or not we need to make adjustments. We're trying very hard to maintain our surgical capacity at the same time as dealing with this pandemic, because we've got such a backlog of cases. You know, those people, their care is being impacted as well. And so we're trying to be extremely sensitive to that and do our very best to continue with the procedures, because there's cancer patients out there. There's patients with symptomatic hernias who can't work, or someone who needs a knee replacement who's having trouble walking. And so we're trying to balance that with also responding to the pandemic.
Yeah, and Dr. Kavanaugh, I think it's important to me because we use the term elective surgery, right? And so I think a lot of times there's this perception that it's not a necessary surgery. And can you clarify that?
Yeah, when we say elective, it means that there's not a specific time frame in which it needs to be completed. So for example, if I have a hernia, it could be done tomorrow, or it could be done a month from now without having a negative impact on my care. We're not talking about things like cosmetic surgery that are truly, discretionary. And, I'm getting something done just because I want to improve, the way I look. So elective just means there's not an urgency to it. All along, we've been doing urgent and emergent cases. We've never stopped doing that. But some of the cases that we felt like it would not negatively impact the patient significantly long term, we did have to delay, especially during the Delta surge. And so right now we're doing our very best, to continue to get the patients in the operating room and get their procedures done, because we know it impacts people, even if they're quote unquote elective. We know that they need to have their procedures completed.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Pate, Melissa writes in and she says, what's the best day to test a child when we are notified of an exposure from a child's school? I've seen anywhere from days 3 to 5, days 4 to 6. My son's school is requiring a test on exposure day 7 to return to school.
Yeah, it is a moving target because of the different variants that we've dealt with. So I think a good rule of thumb is that it depends on what kind of testing you're going to do, whether you're going to be doing the PCR test or whether you're going to be doing the rapid antigen test. And I think that's where some of the confusion comes in too, because you're with Omicron, your PCR test is going to be positive about a full day ahead of when a rapid antigen test might become positive. So what we generally do is if your child's been exposed and they don't have symptoms, then get them tested around day 5. If you do it day 4, that's fine. If you do it day 6, that's fine. If you have to do it at a certain time for the school, do that. But generally around day 5 plus or minus is going to be good. If you're testing now, if your child develops symptoms, then go ahead and get them tested.
Dr. Kavanaugh, Deb has 2 little grandsons who are sick at home. So here's her question. Is it possible for family members to reinfect each other after having tested positive for COVID and having had symptoms?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about those sick kiddos. It's extremely unlikely. And the reason for that is that you develop immunity. And we know that immunity wanes over time, both from vaccination and infection. But if someone, if someone contracts COVID and is dealing with that and then transmits it to family members, the person who transmitted it will have a period of time when they're very unlikely to contract it again in the short interval. Now, if they don't get vaccinated in the longer interval, we've seen plenty of people who are coming back with their second round of COVID. It's typically, many months to a year or longer after the initial case. But in the example that you shared, Gemma, it's extremely unlikely because of that short-term immunity.
Dr. Pate, Bob writes, is there evidence that the Moderna vaccine does better at protecting people against the Omicron variant?
There's not great evidence that that's the case. There are some things that you could point to that you would say, I wonder if that does give the Moderna an edge over the Pfizer, but really for what we can say that we know, they are both extremely effective and would not, I don't think most healthcare providers would have a strong preference of one over the other.
Dr. Cavanaugh, Dolores writes, if someone had COVID in December, how likely are they to become infected if they're exposed to the Omicron variant? Also, can you estimate the length of immunity after a symptomatic episode of the Delta variant?
So someone was infected with Delta or exposed to Delta? I'm sorry, I missed that part.
It sounds like they were infected with Delta in December, so they want to know the length of their immunity with that.
Gotcha.
But then also, if they're exposed to Omicron, how likely is it that they would be reinfected?
Yeah, I would give you sort of a two-part answer. You know, they've got some immunity that's going to last for several months. The question I would ask back to the person is, you know, what are you going to do with that information? I would still be careful. I would still mask and avoid crowds and do all those things. And so just because, hey, I've got some immunity doesn't mean, you know, you don't need to take all the precautions that we've recommended numerous times. So, yes, very unlikely to get infected. However, would still recommend being cautious out amongst crowds.
Dr. Pate, Jan wrote in, she goes, if a parent tests positive and has symptoms, but the spouse and kids are negative, can the kids go to school wearing N95 masks? And can the spouse go to work without isolating?
So a lot of that's going to depend on whether the spouse and the child is vaccinated, fully vaccinated. And hopefully if they were due for a booster, if they got the booster. So yes, if they're fully vaccinated and boosted, if appropriate, then they can certainly go back. It's certainly a good practice, given that they will have had an exposure, plus just the disease level activity that we have, that they should be wearing a mask when they're around others. This has been one of the things that has been also very dramatic, as kind of like that graph that we talked about at the beginning of the program. If you have a person in the family that becomes infected, but all the other family members are fully vaccinated, the chance that they're going to get infected from that person, even though you're living with them, it just dramatically drops. On the other hand, if those other persons in the family are not fully vaccinated, they're going to be at significant risk.
Dr. Cavanaugh, Rick in CUNA just wrote in, and he says, aren't media reports on total COVID cases in Idaho a bit deceiving as those numbers come from healthcare providers? What about positive cases based on at-home tests? How does that affect hospitals that are trying to prepare for a surge? So I think he's saying that maybe the numbers are higher.
Yeah, I agree. I think the numbers are higher, and we just don't know how much higher, right? I mean, there's plenty of people doing at-home tests who, I mean, that information doesn't get reported to the state. There are also people who get symptoms and say, oh, it's probably COVID. I'm just going to, you know, isolate for 5 days. So it's tough to really know what the true incidence is. I think we can accurately assume that the numbers are higher than what we're seeing reported. And, you know, there's certain places across the state, there's several places that are doing testing. And so that gives us a sense as far as the increasing rate of positivity and the number of positives that are coming out of those locations. But I think we can all agree that they're overall, it's an underreporting of the total number of cases across the state and the United States.
Because Dr. Cavanaugh, I even know people personally where let's say they're a family of four, right? And one person, everybody gets symptoms, but one person only goes in and maybe gets a PCR test. And I'm like, well, and it comes back positive, so they don't even test anybody else in the house.
Right, exactly. I think that's happening more and more. And so, yeah, I think the numbers that we're seeing are underreported, and we can assume they're a lot higher than what we're seeing.
We have a few minutes left in the program today, and I would like your thoughts, both of your thoughts, on this question that Randy writes. He says, when it comes to COVID, when will we go back to something more normal? And Dr. Cavanaugh, you know, I think about this. I think we all think about this quite a bit. And there are times where I think, well, this in a lot of ways, isn't this our new normal? I know there are things that I will, I think, continue to do for the rest of my life. I will likely wear a mask in the wintertime. I will wear a mask on an airplane. I don't necessarily see that behavior changing. But with that said, I don't know if we're ever going to go back to how it was in you know, December of 2019.
Yeah, you're asking to predict the future a little bit, right? And so it's really hard to know. The question around masking in the wintertime is fascinating to me because, you know, historically, we've just accepted that we lose 20,000, 30,000 Americans every winter due to flu. And what we saw when we adopted widespread masks across the U.S. is flu deaths dropped dramatically. And so if we did mask every winter, what would be the outcome? You know, how many deaths would we avoid because fewer vulnerable people got infected? I think it's a great question to ask. As far as getting back to normal, you know, gosh, we all want that, right? Well, we're all tired of this pandemic, and we want things to resemble some sense of normalcy. I will say, you know, I do think it's possible that we are closer to the end of this than we have been, especially with Omicron, because the transmission is just so great that hopefully for at least several months we'll have widespread immunity that's a combination of vaccine-induced immunity and Omicron-induced immunity. So I do think at least in the short term we will see a decrease in the number of these waves. And I think you're exactly right. We're going to have to figure out how to live with this thing just like we did with flu. And it will be, you know, part of our part of what we have to deal with going forward.
And Dr. Pate, we have about 2 minutes left. I would love your thoughts on this.
Yeah, you know, it's a common question. First of all, we cannot live with coronavirus at these levels of transmission. We see what it's doing to our hospitals and our schools. So we've got to get the transmission levels down. I'm hopeful Dr. Kavanaugh is right, and that Omicron, because it's infecting so many people, it would be fantastic if it would give us some durable immunity. Unfortunately, all the early reports, these aren't published yet because they're so early, but we're seeing people getting even reinfected with Omicron itself. So get Omicron and they get infected again. So I think I'm kind of skeptical at this moment to think that Omicron's natural immunity is going to be anywhere as good as even the previous variants.
Well, as always, we so appreciate both of you coming on and answering people's questions, giving us the science, giving us the facts. There was still so much misinformation out there, even 2+ years into this pandemic. So our thanks to both of you for what you are doing on a daily basis to keep all of us safe and moving forward. Thank you to Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, and Dr. Rob Kavanaugh, who is the director, the president, rather, of St. Luke's Clinic. I appreciate you both so very much.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thanks, Gemma.
And I want to thank all of you, our listeners, for joining us and for, of course, participating, sending us your questions. We will have our medical experts back next week. So get us your questions, Idaho Matters, at boisestate.edu. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. It is Wednesday. I hope you have a great rest of your day. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you back here tomorrow.